get another drink. If anything, she needs food. She was so busy worrying about Mac and Betty and getting them set with their lobsters that she hadn't eaten anything. I'm starving, she says to herself.
You and me both.
Celeste turns to see Shooter at her right shoulder. She looks for Benji. He's up front, talking to Mimi, the Broadway dancer.
He's occupied, Shooter says. Let's go get pizza.
He grabs her hand. I can't, Celeste says. She's afraid to look at him, so she stares down at her feet in her jeweled sandals. Her toes are painted a color called Sunshine State of Mind to match her dress tonight. She does leave her hand in his, however, for a few forbidden seconds.
We'll come right back, Shooter says. He whistles sharply, and Benji spins around. I'm taking your bride to get a slice. Back in 10.
Benji waves, then turns again to Mimi and Kermit, who has joined their conversation. He couldn't care less. Okay, Celeste says. Let's go. There's a line outside Steamboat Pizza and a steady stream of cars unloading from the late ferry. Celeste feels weirdly exposed, and she distances herself half a step from Shooter. She has dreamed of being alone with him, but now that it's happening, she's tongue-tied. Across the street, she sees a woman with long jet-black hair wearing suede booties with shorts. Suede booties in July. Even Celeste recognizes that as a no-no. And the woman looks like she's pointing her phone at Celeste and Shooter. Taking a picture? Celeste turns her back. She wants to make a joke about the care and feeding of the bride, but she can't manage small talk and, apparently, neither can Shooter.
Follow me, he says.
He gets out of line, which is fine. Celeste wouldn't have been able to eat anything in front of him anyway, and starts walking down the street toward the ferry dock. Celeste follows, bobbing and weaving, skirting groups of teenagers, dodging couples with strollers, stopping short so an elderly couple can pass. She doesn't ask Shooter where they're going. She doesn't care. She would follow him anywhere. They cross the Steamship Authority parking lot, Shooter striding ahead, and then he cuts to the right of the terminal building and turns to check that she's behind him. He waits for her, places a hand on her back, and ushers her to a bench at the edge of the dock. The view is over the working part of the harbor. It's not glamorous, but it's still pretty. Everything on Nantucket is pretty. They sit side by side, their thighs touching, and then Shooter wraps his arm around Celeste's shoulders. She suddenly feels the effect of the wine she drank earlier. She acts impulsively. She doesn't care who sees. She buries her face in Shooter's chest and inhales the scent of him. He is all she wants.
Run away with me, he says.
She takes a breath to say, yeah, right, but he stops her.
I'm serious, Celeste. I'm in love with you. I know it's wrong. I know it's unfair. I know all of our friends will hate us, especially my own best friend. Hell, my brother. Because Benji is by every standard my brother. I don't care. I do care, but I care about you more. I have never felt this way about anyone before. My feelings for you are tragic. They're Shakespearean. I'm not sure which play, some combination of Hamlet and Romeo and Juliet, I think. I want you to sneak out of the house and meet me here. Right here, at 6:15 tomorrow morning. I'll have 2 tickets on the 6:30 ferry. The boat gets to Hyannis at 8:30, which is also our scheduled reveille tomorrow, so by the time people realize we're both gone, we'll be safely on the mainland.
Celeste nods against his chest. She's not agreeing, but she wants to hear more. She wants to imagine this escape. The anxiety that has been squeezing her heart loosens its grip. She gets a clear breath.
You can say no. I expect you to say no. And if you do say no, I'll show up at the altar tomorrow right next to Benji like I promised. I will give a sweet, meaningful toast with the appropriate amount of humor and at least one line about how Benji doesn't deserve you. I will ask for one dance with you and when that dance is over, I'll give you a peck on the cheek and let you get on with the rest of your life. With him.
Celeste exhales.
If you come with me, I will buy 4 tickets to Las Vegas. 1 for me, 1 for you, 2 for your parents. And I will marry you by the end of the day tomorrow. Or we can move more slowly. But I need you to know that I am serious. I'm in love with you. If you don't feel the same way, I will still go to my grave feeling grateful for every second I have had with you. If nothing else, you prove that the heart of Michael Oscar Uxley is not made of stone.
Michael Oscar Uxley, she thinks. She realizes with shock that she has never asked his real name.
Yes, she says.
What?
She raises her face. She looks into Shooter's blue eyes, but what she sees is her parents in profile from the back seat of their old Toyota. They are turned toward each other, singing along to Paradise by the Dashboard Light. Do you love me? Will you love me forever? Celeste is 11 years old. She knows all the words, too, but she doesn't dare sing because the two of them sound so good together. Then she flashes back to before they were Mac and Betty to her, before they were even Mommy and Daddy, back to when they were just ideas. Love, security, warmth. Celeste is young, only 1 or 2 years old. They are playing a game called Flying Baby. Bruce has Celeste by one hand and Karen has her by the other. They swing Celeste between them until Bruce calls out, "Flying?" And Karen calls out, "Baby!" And they lift Celeste up off the ground. For one delicious moment, she is suspended in midair, weightless. Finally, she thinks of her parents as teenagers. Her mother in her red tank suit, her father in his sweatpants and hoodie, staring at the orange. The moment their eyes meet, the moment their hands touch, that certainty, that recognition.
You are the one.
This is what it feels like. Nothing, as it turns out, can take the place of love.
Yes, she says.
Saturday, July 7th, 2018, 5:45 p.m. The Chief. He finds Thomas in the kitchen, scarfing down a turkey sandwich. Next to the sandwich plate is a highball glass of scotch, 3/4 full.
Mr. Winbury, the chief says.
Thomas, he says, wiping his hands hastily on a napkin and then extending one to the chief.
Mr. Winbury is my father. I have a few questions, the chief says.
You've talked to just about everyone else, Thomas says.
I don't know that I'd have much to add.
Please, the chief says. He's too low on patience to deal with a runaround.
Follow me.
He heads down the hall and around the corner to the living room. Thomas has abandoned the sandwich but brought the scotch, and the chief can't blame him. Thomas takes a seat on the sofa, crosses his ankle over his knee, and sinks back into the cushions like a man without a care in the world. And the chief closes the door.
Events of last night? The chief asks. After the party?
Back bar at Ventuno, boarding house. I left after one drink. My wife called to say she wanted me home, pronto.
What did you do at home?
Went up to see Abby. She was asleep, so I went downstairs for a drink.
Did anyone join you?
My father?
Anyone else?
No.
Are you sure about that?
Thomas's eyebrows shoot up, but it's acting. He's a man pretending to remember something.
The chief is surprised he doesn't snap his fingers.
Oh! After a while, Merritt joined us, as well as a friend of my parents named Featherly Dale. She's an antiques dealer from London, here for the wedding.
Why was Featherly Dale at the house so late? The chief asks. Is she staying here?
No. I'm not sure why she was still around.
You're not?
I'm not.
The chief lets the lie sit there for a moment, stinking. The four of you sat under the tent drinking rum, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Who was the first to leave the tent? Was it you?
It was. My wife called down. I had pushed my luck by then already, so I went up to bed.
Do you have any idea what time that was?
Around 2, I think.
I need you to focus here. Do you remember Featherly Dale going into the kitchen for water? A glass of water for Ms. Monaco?
Thomas shakes his head, but then says, yes.
When Featherly went in to get the water, do you recall how long she was gone?
5 minutes. Maybe a bit longer.
Did you have any of the water?
No, sir.
Do you remember anyone else having any of the water? Even a sip?
I was there to drink rum, sir, Thomas says. I don't remember much about the water.
Somewhere in the house, the clock strikes 6. The chief is dying to get home, take off his shoes, crack open a beer, hug his wife, talk to Chloe. This day has lasted 5 years, but that's the way it is with murder cases. He's sure that, back at the station, his voicemail is filled with messages from insistent reporters. When this is all over, he's going to need another stress management class.
Let me switch gears.
Does your mother have a pillbox?
Excuse me?
Does your mother have a box where she keeps her...
her sleeping pills? Thomas says.
Yes, it's round. It has a picture of Queen Elizabeth on it.
Would you say this pillbox is well known to members of your family?
Thomas laughs.
Oh, yes. My mother's pillbox is infamous. It was a gift from her grandmother.
And would you say that everyone in your family is aware that it holds sleeping pills?
Yes. And she won't share them. I asked for one once and she told me I couldn't handle it.
Really? The chief says. Greer claimed she offered Merritt one of the sleeping pills. So they were too strong for her son, but she gave one to a house guest? Does that seem likely?
No, it does not.
Did you see the pillbox in the kitchen last night?
No, Thomas says.
Why? Was it left out?
He sits up straighter.
Do you think Merritt took one of my mother's sleeping pills?
You didn't see the pillbox? The chief asks.
You didn't touch the pills?
Thomas slaps his knee.
I most certainly did not. But Merritt must have seen my mother's pills and taken one. Or even 2, not realizing how potent they are. And then she went for a swim.
He stands up.
I think everyone will be fine with this being called an accidental death. There's no reason to manufacture any more drama. This little inquisition has produced enough anxiety as it is.
We're not finished here, the chief says.
He waits while Thomas reluctantly sits back down.
Do you know anything about a cut on Merritt's foot?
A cut? Thomas says. No. But if she did cut her foot, maybe she went into the water to rinse it.
This isn't something the chief has considered. She did have quite a nasty gash on her foot. It's possible she rinsed it off in the water to avoid tracking blood into the Winbury house. The only place they'd seen blood was in the sand.
Also, Merritt had been drinking, Thomas says.
The chief doesn't respond to this. It's interesting that Thomas is so eager to offer up theories about what happened. The chief has been at this long enough to know that that is how a guilty person acts.
What is your relationship with Ms. Dale? The chief asks.
I already told you. She's a friend of my parents.
And that's it? You don't have a personal relationship with her?
Not really, Thomas says.
No. My colleague with the Massachusetts State Police interviewed Ms. Dale, the chief says. She told him that she had been romantically involved with you, but that you broke things off in May when your wife got pregnant. Is that true?
No.
Thomas says. One of you is lying, the chief says.
Featherly is lying. She's a pathological liar, in fact. She's being investigated for fraud in her antiques business.
Did she tell your colleague that?
She tried to pass off a fake George III Giltwood table to what she thought was a naive client. So clearly, she lies as a general practice.
That seems like pretty specialized knowledge to have about your parents' friend, the chief says.
My mother told me about it.
Your mother? So if I ask Greer right now if she told you about Featherly's fraud charges and what exactly they were, she'll say yes.
Thomas nods. His expression is confident except for three tense lines high on his forehead.
The chief stands up. All right, I'll go talk to your mother.
Wait, Thomas says. He collapses against the back of the sofa.
We did have a brief fling. Me and Ms. Dale.
Featherly.
How brief? The chief asks.
Thomas throws up his hands.
Not brief, exactly, but sporadic.
He pauses. Several years. The chief sits back down.
So, you've been romantically involved with Ms. Dale for several years?
On and off, Thomas says.
And like she told you, I ended things in May. Did it upset you that Ms. Dale chose to attend the wedding?
Of course it upset me, Thomas says. I want her out of my life. My wife is pregnant. I need to focus on her and on getting my career back on track. This thing with Featherly, well, it ran amok. She was blackmailing me.
Blackmailing you? The chief says.
Thomas picks up his scotch and throws half of it back. The chief feels a mixture of triumph and shame. He has gotten people to break down and talk before, and it always feels satisfying on the one hand, like cracking a safe almost, and vaguely obscene on the other. This guy has been hiding something for years, and now he's coming clean. So many crimes, and especially murders, are committed by people with dark motivations like Thomas. Thomas likely had no intention of killing anyone. He just wanted to keep the secret of his love affair safe. I hooked up with her initially after her older brother, Hamish, died. Hamish was a school friend of my father's. I went to the funeral with my parents. This was before I met Abby. And at the reception afterward, Featherly and I got drunk and things happened. After that, I saw her whenever I was in London or she was in New York. Then I met Abby. I told Featherly I couldn't see her anymore and she went off the deep end.
How so?
Abby came with my family to Virgin Gorda over the Christmas holiday the first year we were together. Featherly must have found out because she showed up on Virgin Gorda with a client of hers from Abu Dhabi who had a gigantic yacht. And then another time, right after I finished law school, Featherly made a surprise appearance at my classmate's graduation party. She walked right into Bemelman's bar at the Carlisle Hotel in New York and told everyone I'd invited her there.
Why didn't you just correct the misperception then?
Because, well, there had been times that I'd seen Featherly since I'd been with Abby. And that's where I messed up. I didn't make a clean break. I didn't keep Featherly firmly in my past. The first time I wasn't sure if things were going to work out with Abby and me. So when Feather called and told me she had a suite at the Gramercy Park Hotel, I went. Then, after Abby had her second miscarriage, which was a really bad one, she was weepy and depressed, really difficult to be around. She felt like a failure. I felt like a failure. We started to fight. There wasn't a conversation we could have that didn't lead right back to the pregnancies. Sex was out of the question. It was a tough time. And Featherly capitalized on that. She magically appeared in New York and then in Tampa, Florida, where I was assisting on a case. She sent me a first-class plane ticket to Paris and then, a few months later, to Marrakesh. Then, of course, it turned out she was charging her clients the price of my plane tickets, thinking they wouldn't notice. But of course they did, and they dragged Featherly to court, which killed her business and depleted her savings and caused her to do something stupid, like try to pass off a fake George III Giltwood table as genuine. The chief nods. He has his guy. He can feel it.
The blackmail, he says.
The blackmail, Thomas says. He throws back the rest of his scotch, and the chief wishes for the bottle, anything to keep him talking. It started back in January of this year. I wanted to break things off. And Feather told me if I did, she would tell Abby what we'd been doing. So I had to keep on.
Thomas presses his fingers into his eye sockets. I started failing at work. I was trying to get Abby pregnant and trying to keep Featherly from running her mouth. Then, in May, Abby got pregnant and the pregnancy seemed strong and viable. And I just made a decision that I wasn't going to let Featherly Dale control me any longer. The fraud charges helped because I figured even if she did contact Abby, she would have zero credibility.
But even so, you must have been upset that Ms. Dale was attending your brother's wedding.
I asked her not to come, Thomas says. I pleaded and begged.
And threatened, the chief says. Ms. Dale said that you said if she showed her face on Nantucket, you would kill her. Did you say that?
Thomas nods. Yes. Yes, I did.
Did you drop one of your mother's sleeping pills into the glass of water Featherly brought to the table, thinking she would be the one to drink it? Did you think she might take a swim and drown, or get behind the wheel of a car and have an accident? Did you do that, Thomas? Because after what you've told me, I would understand if you did.
Thomas starts to cry. I've made such a mess of things.
The chief breathes all the way out, maybe for the first time since he woke up this morning.
I'll need you to come down to the station and sign a statement. You have the right to an attorney.
Thomas sniffs, shakes his head. I think you've misunderstood. I've made a mess of things, but I didn't drug anyone. I didn't see my mother's pills. I didn't touch the glass of water. And you'll forgive me, but it would take a hell of a lot more than a measly sleeping pill to kill Featherly Dale.
So you, the chief says, you didn't.
Thomas shakes his head again.
I wanted Featherly to disappear. But I didn't put anything in anyone's water. I didn't see or touch my mother's sleeping pills, and Featherly is still very much a threat to me.
Thomas offers the chief a sad smile.
That is the truth.
The chief calls Andrea and tells her he's on his way home.
Did you figure out what happened? Andrea says.
Not quite, the chief says. We uncovered a bunch of ugly secrets, don't get me wrong, but we can't quite link any of them to the death of the young woman.
He thinks of Jordan Randolph at the Nantucket Standard. He's going to have questions. Everyone is going to have questions.
How's Chloe?
She's upset, Andrea says. She told me she bonded with the maid of honor at the rehearsal dinner.
Bonded? The chief says. What does that mean?
I tried to get more out of her, but she said she wanted to talk to you. I told her you were very busy.
No, no, it's fine, the chief says.
He wonders if the answers he's been looking for are under his own roof.
I'll be there in a few minutes.
The chief knocks on Chloe's bedroom door.
Come in, she says.
She's lying on her bed reading a book about turtles.
Is that right?
Turtles all the way down, the cover says.
The chief has no idea what that means, but he's glad she's reading.
Her phone is plugged in on the nightstand, and it buzzes and blinks with incoming messages. Instagrams, he supposes, or Snapchats, or whatever has replaced Instagram and Snapchat. Nick would probably know.
Hey, he says with what remains of his good humor.
He closes the door behind him and takes a seat on her bright blue fuzzy chair. The chair reminds the chief of Grover from Sesame Street, but at least it's comfortable.
Auntie said you wanted to talk?
Chloe nods, sets the book down, sits up. She isn't wearing any makeup, which is unusual. Her face is maturing into beauty, a beauty she inherited from her mother. Tess wasn't much older than Chloe is now when the chief first met her. Andrea's beloved younger cousin, a cousin as close as a sister.
There are two things I want to tell you, Chloe says, about last night.
Go ahead, the chief says.
I was eavesdropping during the party, Chloe says. I overheard a conversation between the maid of honor and the father of the groom. I think they were involved. I know they were. She was pregnant with his baby. He wanted her to get rid of it. He said he would write her a check. She said she wanted to keep the baby because it was a link to him. She said she would tell Greer. Greer is his wife.
The chief nods and tries not to let any emotion show on his face. He's appalled that this particular storyline managed to make its way to Chloe.
You haven't told anyone that, I hope, the chief says. That's volatile information.
I haven't told a soul, Chloe says softly. I was waiting for you to get home.
After dealing with one liar after another all day long, the chief is heartened to know he recognizes the truth when he hears it. He takes a deep breath.
What's the other thing?
The other thing happened when I was clearing, Chloe says. It was after the dessert, after the toasts, and I had a tray of champagne flutes I was taking back to the kitchen. I wasn't watching where I was going, and I tripped and fell, and the glasses all broke.
Broken glass, the chief thinks. Where did this happen? He asks.
At the place where the beach meets the lawn. Over by the left side of the house if you're standing with your back to the water.
The chief writes this down.
The maid of honor helped me clean up, Chloe says. And she was really cool. She asked my name and where I was from. And when I told her I was from Nantucket, she said I was the luckiest girl in the world.
Chloe's voice gets thick and she wipes at her eyes.
I can't believe she's dead. She was a person I talked to last night.
Sometimes things happen that way, the chief says. There's a good chance she took pills. Maybe drank too much.
She wasn't drunk, Chloe says. Not even a little bit. She seemed like the most sober person at the party.
I just want you to realize, Chloe, that every single decision you make, who your friends are, who you date, whether you decide to smoke or drink, has a consequence. I think that Merritt, ultimately, was the victim of her own poor choices.
Chloe stares at the chief for a second, and he can see she resents his using Merritt's death as a public service announcement. But this is nothing if not a teachable moment. Chloe reaches for her phone, and the chief knows he's lost her. Andrea is better at dealing with Chloe. He always ends up sounding like the gruff uncle who also happens to be the chief of police.
One other question, Chloe, he says,
though he's sure she wants nothing more than to be rid of him.
Did Merritt cut herself when she was helping you clean up the glass?
Cut herself? Chloe says.
She looks up from her phone.
No. Why?
Just wondering, the chief says. Are you sure the two of you picked up every bit of glass?
It was dark, Chloe says. We did the best we could. I was worried, actually, that Greer would find a piece of glass we missed, and I would get in trouble for it today. But I guess they had bigger things to worry about.
The chief stands up.
Wait, can I show you one more thing? Chloe says.
She holds her phone up and scoots to the edge of the bed. The chief takes a seat next to her.
Merritt is an influencer, so I started following her on Instagram last night when I got home. This was her last post.
The chief accepts the phone from Chloe and puts on his reading glasses. He has never looked at Instagram before, and he sees it's nothing more than a photograph with a caption. In this instance, the photo is of two young women posing on the bow of the Highline Fast Ferry. Their hair is windblown, and Nantucket is visible behind them in the background. The harbor, the sailboats, the gray shingled fishermen cottages of the wharves, the steeples of the Unitarian and Congregational churches. The blonde, Celeste, the bride, the chief realizes, looks nervous. There's a hesitation in her smile. The brunette, Merritt, however, is beaming. She is luminous, giving the moment everything she has.
She's a good actress, the chief thinks.
There's no hint or clue that she was pregnant with the baby of a married man and that he wanted nothing to do with her. The caption of the photo reads, "Go into the chapel. Wedding weekend with the best friend a woman could ask for. Hashtag maid of honor. Hashtag bridesmaid. Hashtag happily ever after."
Hashtag happily ever after, Chloe says.
That's the part that kills me. Isn't that the saddest thing you've ever seen?
Just about, the chief says, handing the phone back to Chloe. Just about. The chief changes into casual clothes and looks longingly at the cold blue cans of Cisco beer in his fridge, but he can't relax yet. He has arranged to meet Nick back at the station to go over everything one last time. Don't worry about dinner, he tells Andrea. I'll have Kira order us something.
I hate murder investigations, Andrea says, lifting her face for a kiss. But I love you.
And I love you, he says.
He gives his wife a kiss, a second kiss, a third kiss.
He thinks about letting Nick wait. The chief and Nick meet in an interview room back at the station. Kira, the chief's assistant, has ordered a kale Caesar and a couple of artisanal pizzas from Station 21 so they can have a little dinner. Nick takes a lusty bite of the shrimp and pancetta pizza. This isn't bad, he says. Normally I stay away from anything called artisanal. I like my food real. Chloe said Merritt didn't cut herself when she helped clean up, the chief says. But she may have cut herself after the kayak ride. The place Chloe said she dropped the tray is right near the path Merritt would have taken to get back to her cottage. That could explain why Merritt went in the water, Nick says. I mean, you'd rinse a cut at the water's edge, but you wouldn't go all the way in. Unless the water felt nice, the chief says. It was a hot night. And I'm guessing the maid of honor didn't care for the heat, Nick says. The AC in her bedroom was cranked to 10. It was practically snowing in there. But that doesn't tell us who slipped her the sleeping pill, the chief says. She might have taken one herself, Nick says. After all, we know she was upset. Doesn't that seem reckless? The chief asks. Taking a sleeping pill when she's pregnant? The father said she jumped off the kayak way out in the middle of the harbor, right? That's the definition of reckless. Her frame of mind was reckless, sounds like. The chief stabs a piece of kale in the round foil container in front of them. I'm not liking this as an accident. There are two people who wanted Merritt to go away. Tag Winbury and Greer Garrison. And one person who wanted Featherly Dale to go away. Thomas Winbury. Calling it an accident would be easier on Merritt's family, Nick says. And the bride. We don't work for her family, the chief says. We work for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And beyond that, we work in the name of justice for the citizens of this great country. Do you think it was an accident? Really? No, Nick says. I like the mother. The chief munches a crouton. Funny. I like the father. Tag Winbury sees his wife's sleeping pills, drops one in Merritt's water glass. He then takes her out in the kayak and eliminates both his problems. No mistress, no baby. What's your angle? Greer finds out about the affair and the baby, and she drops a sleeping pill in the water, hoping Merritt will drink it and that Tag will take Merritt out in the kayak. Or maybe, maybe, Greer is trying to kill her husband. Maybe Greer slips him a Mickey, hoping he'll go out in the kayak and never return. Nick picks up a piece of the sausage pizza. Yes, I do realize how far-fetched that sounds. It would be different, maybe, if we had that water glass, the chief says. Nick cocks his head. Does it seem odd to you that the water glass was cleared from the table, but the shot glasses remained? Someone took only the water glass inside. Or someone came out and cleared only the water glass. The chief shakes his head and picks up his own piece of pizza. He can't believe that Chloe is the one who dropped the tray of glasses. Shard of glass on the lawn, cut foot, maid of honor goes into the ocean to wash it off, dead maid of honor. It's not Chloe's fault. No one on earth would think that. But if Chloe hadn't dropped the tray, would Merritt still be alive? Yes, if she hadn't taken a sleeping pill or been slipped a sleeping pill and then gone into the water, she would be alive. Limping down the aisle of the church, maybe, but alive. The fact is, we don't have enough evidence to charge anyone, Nick says.
The chief knows Nick is right.
Tomorrow we'll call the brother back and tell him we concluded it was an accident. She took a sleeping pill. She went for a nighttime swim. She drowned.
There were so many secrets in that house, Nick says. I can't believe one of them didn't cause this.
The chief raises his cup of coffee.
To the deceased, he says.
Nick touches his cup to the chief's. May she rest in peace.
Saturday, July 7th, 2018, 6:55 p.m. Nantucket. The Nantucket Standard, www.ackstandard.net, Saturday, July 7th, 2018. Nantucket Police Department rules drowning death accidental. 8:12 p.m. The Nantucket Police Department, in conjunction with the Massachusetts State Police, has ruled the death of Merritt Allison Monaco, 29, of New York, New York, early this morning, an accident. Ms. Monaco was on Nantucket to serve as an attendant at a wedding on Saturday. She is survived by her parents, Gary and Catherine Monaco, of Comac, New York, as well as a brother, Douglas Monaco, of Garden City, New York. Ms. Monaco was employed by the New York Wildlife Conservation Society and has served as their director of public relations since 2016. Chief Edward Kapanash of the Nantucket Police Department said,
"We have investigated the case and determined Ms. Monaco's death was an accident. We thank the entire Nantucket community for their cooperation and encourage locals and visitors to the island alike to exercise extreme caution in and around the water."
Marty Skazerba gets an alert from the Inky on his phone. The maid of honor out in Monomoy apparently drowned accidentally. It sounds suspicious to Marty, and it also feels a bit anticlimactic. After the person of interest trying to escape on the High Line and the dramatic removal of Featherly Dale from the Crosswinds restaurant, it turns out the death was accidental?
Huh, Marty thinks.
Then Marty realizes this means Featherly Dale isn't a murder suspect, and thus might be interested in a little romance. Marty can't see himself pursuing anything like a one-night stand, but a drink might be nice. He decides to call the police station to ask Kira if she knows if Featherly was brought back to the airport or taken to stay at an inn overnight.
"Hey, Kira," Marty says when she answers. "This is Marty Skazerba. I have a question for you."
"Hey, Marty," Kira says. Just the sound of her voice reminds Marty that he still harbors a terrific crush on Kira. "I have a question for you. When are you ever going to ask me out?"
Marty blinks. The phone grows warm in his hand. "Featherly who?" he thinks.
"How about tonight?" he says.
Celeste texts Benji to let him know she's taking a taxi back from the hospital.
"I'll just come get you," Benji texts.
"Please don't," Celeste responds.
Three dots appear, and then a second text comes through.
"We can talk when I get back."
Benji feels suddenly hot and prickly, uncomfortable in his own skin for the first time in his life. How he longs to shed his identity at this moment. He no longer wants to be a Winbury. Celeste has obviously learned about Merritt and Tag. They were having some kind of affair, some kind of something. Benji couldn't bear to press for details, but he has a feeling his father is to blame for Merritt's death. His own father.
"You think your family is beyond reproach," Celeste had said. "But you're wrong."
Benji meets Celeste out in the driveway, but she gives him a hollow look and says,
"I need a minute, please, Benji. I have to talk to my parents."
He says, "Your parents aren't the priority right now, Celeste. I'm your fiancé. We were supposed to get married today." She walks right past him and into the house, and it's all Benji can do not to follow behind her like a puppy dog. Instead, he heads to the kitchen and watches Thomas pile a plate high with sandwiches and potato salad
and summer fruit that the caterer had dropped off earlier that afternoon as scheduled. It was supposed to be the pre-wedding lunch. And when Thomas notices Benji staring at him, he says, "What? I'm hungry, and my wife is pregnant and needs food." Benji says in the calmest voice he can manage, "Is this Dad's fault? Was he screwing her?"
"Sounds like it," Thomas says matter-of-factly.
He notices the look of disgust that crosses Benji's face.
"Oh, don't be such an altar boy, Benny."
"Altar boy?" Benji thinks. Does it make him an altar boy to expect his father to be a man of character and integrity? To not cheat on their mother with someone Benji's age? Someone who also happened to be Celeste's best friend? "Did you know about this?" Benji asks.
"Not really," Thomas says. "But I saw Dad in the bar at the Four Seasons downtown a few weeks ago, and he hid from me. I figured something was going on."
Thomas blinks.
"Now I know what that something was."
Benji shudders. The Four Seasons downtown? It was like that? Like an affair from a novel or a movie? Thomas disappears down the hall with his plate before Benji can ask what Thomas had been doing at the Four Seasons downtown. He doesn't want to know. Benji loiters at the mail table at the bottom of the stairs until he hears Celeste leaving her parents' room. Then he races to the second floor and catches her right before she enters her, his, their bedroom. His bedroom that she was using as a bridal suite that will become their bedroom in this house. "Celeste." She turns.
"I need to lie down," she says.
"I understand you're tired," he says.
He lets her enter the room, follows her, then closes the door behind them.
"Benji," she says.
Her wedding dress is hanging on the closet door. It's as unsettling to him as a headless ghost.
"You're not going to marry me," he says.
"Are you?
Like, at all? Ever?"
"No," she says. "I'm sorry, Benji. I'm not."
Benji's entire body goes numb. He nods, but he feels like his head is being pulled by a string. Celeste. He wants to talk her out of it. He wants to explain that she shouldn't judge him by his family's actions. He's not his father. He's not his brother. He's a good, true person, and he will love her forever. But he stops himself. Every single thing that Benji has comes from his parents. The money, the apartment, the education, the advantages. To denounce his family, to deny his unconditional love for them, would be disingenuous, and Celeste would recognize it as such. He has taken the privilege for granted for 28 years, and now he has to accept the shame.
"What are you going to do?" he asks.
"I'm not sure," she says. "Maybe take a trip. Maybe not."
"I know it seems inconceivable right now," Benji says, "but you will get past this. I don't mean to say you'll ever stop missing Merritt."
"Benji,"
Celeste says, and Benji clamps his mouth shut. He sounds like an ass.
"My decision doesn't have anything to do with Merritt."
"It doesn't?" he says.
She shakes her head.
"It has to do with me."
She doesn't want to marry him. He would like to say this comes as a complete shock, a wrecking ball out of nowhere, but it doesn't.
"Your stutter is gone," he says.
She smiles, sadly at first, but then with a touch of relief, or triumph.
"Yes," she says. "I know."
As Benji is walking back to the first cottage, he needs to hide. He can't bear to see either of his parents. He spies Shooter walking down the driveway. Shooter. Benji has completely lost track of him, of time, of everything. Shooter looks like he's just survived a shipwreck. He's unshaven. His blue Oxford is rumpled and untucked. He has his navy blazer crushed under one arm, and his mouth is hanging open as he stares at his phone.
"You look even worse than I feel," Benji says, trying for the jocular tone they normally use with each other. "Where have you been?" Police station, Shooter says. He follows Benji into the first cottage, then goes straight to the fridge and flips the top off a bottle of beer.
Want one?
Sure, Benji says.
Listen, there are some things you need to know, Shooter says.
Spare me, please, Benji says. I've heard too much already.
Spare me, please. I've heard too much already.
Shooter lets that comment sink in. He was finally released from the police station. In the end, they had nothing to hold him on except impeding an active investigation. They issued him a ticket for $300, which he paid in cash. Val Gluckstern had offered him a ride back to Summerland, but he said he wanted to walk. He needed to clear his head. He hadn't been sure how much he would need to explain. Maybe everything. Maybe nothing. He wanted very badly to talk to Celeste, but he was afraid. He had spilled the beans to the police, which already felt like a betrayal. He was afraid Celeste would be angry, but he was more afraid she would deny that she had ever intended to run away with him. As he was walking down the Winbury's white shell driveway, between the rows of hydrangeas and under the boxwood arch, his phone pinged. It was a text from an unfamiliar 212 number. Shooter had clicked on the text more out of habit than anything else. It was a picture of Shooter and Celeste standing outside Steamboat Pizza. They weren't touching, though they were very close together. Too close, probably. Shooter clicked on the photo and zoomed in. Celeste was looking in the vague direction of the camera, and Shooter was looking at Celeste, his expression one of naked desire, longing, covetousness. The photo is chilling, a threat. Did someone else know their plans? Who took it? Who sent it? Shooter stopped dead in his tracks. He texted back, "Who is this?" To which there was no response. Shooter ran through the possibilities. The 212 area code was Manhattan, and whoever this was either had been across the street or knew someone who was. The implications were obvious, right? Someone was trying to scare him. If the photo was being sent to Shooter, it had probably also been sent to Benji. But Benji knew that Shooter and Celeste had gone to get pizza. It wasn't as if someone had sent a picture of Shooter and Celeste a few minutes later, sitting on the bench by the steamship terminal. That would have been harder to explain. Okay, fine. Honestly, Shooter was too tired for games. He proceeded under the boxwood arch and bumped right into Benji. Spare me, please. I've heard too much already. I ran away from the police this morning, Shooter says. They wanted to question me, and I told them I had to use the John, and then I slipped out the bathroom window. Shut up, Benji says. I'm serious. Benji says, I hope you told them you didn't want to talk to the police because of what happened to your mother. Shooter takes a long pull off his beer. Benji is the only person who knows about Shooter's mother, Cassandra. She became addicted to heroin after Shooter's father died, but she had happened to OD during one of Shooter's rare visits home. He was 21 years old, working as a bartender in Georgetown, and he gave Cassandra a $50 bill. She had spent it on smack. Shooter had woken up in the morning to find his mother dead. And yes, he had blamed himself. He had basically begged the Dade County police to arrest him, but they had far too much experience with overdoses to blame anyone but the user herself. I hopped on the High Line and they caught me, cuffed me, brought me to the police station. I hired a lawyer. She sat with me while I gave my account of last night. Benji barely reacts. It's as if he expects these kind of theatrics from Shooter. Either that or he's not really listening. They found something in Merritt's bloodstream, Benji says. Pills. Really? Shooter says. How is Celeste taking it? Benji shoots up off the sofa. How is Celeste taking it? He says. Well, let's see.
She was so hysterical that she spent half the day in the emergency room. And yet she seems to have gained a certain clarity. She doesn't want to marry me. At all. Ever.
Shooter is suddenly very alert, despite his profound exhaustion. What is Benji going to say next?
She says it has nothing to do with what happened to Merritt. It has to do with her. She doesn't want to marry me. Not next month, not next year, not on a beach in Aruba, not at City Hall in Easton, Pennsylvania. She doesn't want to marry me. When was she going to tell me this? Was she going to stand me up at the altar? Oh, and guess what else? Guess what else? Just guess.
Shooter doesn't want to guess, which is okay, because Benji isn't waiting for an answer.
Her stutter is gone. Completely gone. She decides she's not going to marry me, and her speech impediment disappears.
Her stutter was gone last night, Shooter thinks. If Benji had paid attention, he would have realized that. When Celeste and Shooter left the beach next to the steamship terminal, they had gone back to get pizza, and when Shooter asked Celeste what she wanted, she said,
"Slice of pepperoni and a root beer, please."
Her words had been as clear as the peal of church bells on a summer morning.
"Did she say anything else?" Shooter asks.
His plan of running away with Celeste was incredibly cowardly, he sees now. Because this, Benji's reckoning, wasn't anything Shooter wanted to witness.
"Anything else?" Benji says. "She didn't need to say anything else. She destroyed me."
He winds up and throws his beer bottle across the room, where it hits the wall and shatters. Benji puts his hands over his face. He makes a choking noise, and Shooter realizes he's crying. Shooter Uxley has envied Benjamin Winbury since the day they met at the St. George's School freshman year, and although Shooter has always longed to have something, anything that Benji couldn't have, all that comes to mind now are the infinite kindnesses that Benji has shown him. The day after Shooter's mother died, Benji skipped his economics midterm at Hobart and flew down to Miami. During their senior year at St. George's, when Shooter was so destitute that he organized an illegal dice game, it was Benji who had encouraged people to come and gamble. Benji had been a prefect. He could have gotten in trouble, lost his position, faced suspension, but none of that had been as important to him as giving Shooter the opportunity to make enough money to stay at school. Benji had picked Shooter over his own brother to be his best man. Benji had always believed in Shooter and continues to believe in him, even as Shooter came this close to stealing his bride away. Celeste has done her part. She has broken things off. This is how things should go. Let Benji deal with the breakup, and let Celeste deal with losing Merritt. After some time passes, Shooter and Celeste can be together. How much time will that be, he wonders. He is, by nature, a very impatient person. He wants to start his life with Celeste today. He decides he will keep the picture of himself with Celeste. It arrived like an anonymous gift from the universe. When Shooter looks at it, he will remember that he finally has something in his life worth waiting for. He will remember that she said yes. Shooter stands up. He reaches out for Benji, hugs him tight. He absorbs the shudders of Benji's sobs. He says nothing. Saturday, July 7th, 2018, 8 o'clock p.m. Greer. There's a knock on Greer's bedroom door and she stands.
Yes?
Elita, the housekeeper, enters the room. It's way past time for Elita to leave. Even with the wedding, she was supposed to be gone by 3 so she could attend the ceremony at 4. But here she is, quietly and steadfastly doing her job.
Elita, Greer says,
and tears rise in her eyes. What does it say that in her household she can only trust 2 people, her younger son and her housekeeper? From behind her back, Elita produces Greer's pillbox.
What?
Greer says.
Her novelist mind immediately wonders if Elita had anything to do with Merritt's death. Perhaps Elita learned about the affair and the baby and poisoned the girl out of fealty to Greer. That would be an unexpected upstairs-downstairs twist.
Where did you find this?
Elita says,
in Mr. Thomas's room, in the trash.
In Thomas's room, in the trash. In the trash? Thomas knows how much Greer cherishes this pillbox. She can't believe he would throw it away. Greer takes the box from Elita. There are still pills inside. She can hear them.
Thank you, Elita, Greer says. You can go home.
Elita slips out of the room. Greer returns the pillbox to its rightful place in the medicine cabinet. Then she marches upstairs. As Greer approaches Thomas's bedroom door, she hears yelling. This is hardly surprising. Greer would very much like to yell herself. She quickly realizes the voices she's hearing belong to Thomas and Abby. Greer's first thought is that yelling can't be good for the baby, but then she recalls that her greatest rows with Tag were when she was pregnant. Her hormones had turned her into a lunatic with pendulum swings between elation and despair. The worst row, when Greer was bored out of her mind, pregnant with Thomas, and Tag was at work every night until 10, and on business trips across Europe every weekend, had actually resulted in Greer picking up a pen and writing her first novel, Prey in the Saint-Germain-des-Prés. Greer sighs. Thoughts of her first novel lead her to thoughts of her 21st novel, due in 13 days. Well, it won't get done now, and no one will blame her. Her husband's pregnant mistress was found dead outside her house on the morning of her son's wedding. Greer gets a pass. Greer stands just outside the bedroom door, where she can hear distinct words and phrases. She loathes eavesdropping. She's going to insist they pipe down. The last thing anyone else in this house needs to hear is Thomas and Abby's marital squabbling. But then Greer hears Abby say,
I've known about you and Featherly for years, since Virgin Gorda, since Tony Burkus's graduation party at the Carlisle Hotel.
Amy Lackey told me she saw you with a trashy-looking woman at L'Entrecote in Paris on a weekend you told me you were visiting your parents in London. I've read all your texts and emails and picked through your credit card bills, including the British Airways Visa signature card you think I know nothing about. Greer stops herself from knocking just in time. Thomas and Featherly? Thomas? Featherly is 15 years his senior. Surely that can't be right.
I told you, I broke it off, Thomas says. I broke it off for good in May, as soon as we found out about the baby.
Wait, Greer thinks. Featherly told Greer that she had broken up with a married man in May. It's a disheartening discovery indeed that Thomas seems to have inherited Tag's questionable morals, setting Abby up to be just like Greer a generation later. Thank God Benji is a garrison, through and through.
There is no breaking it off for good when it comes to you and Featherly, Abby says. Look at last night. I saw you with her under the tent. I saw you, and I knew what was going to happen. You were going to appease me by coming upstairs, and then as soon as I was asleep, you were going to screw her in the pool house.
You're crazy, Thomas says. I came upstairs and Featherly left Abby. She left for her inn or her guest house. I don't even know where she was staying. That's how little I cared.
She did not leave, Abby says. I sneaked downstairs while you were in the bathroom brushing your teeth, and I heard her in the powder room humming, The Lady in Red. She wasn't going anywhere. She was lying in wait for you.
At that instant, Greer figures it out. She hurries back down to her bedroom and finds her cell phone. She sends a text to both Thomas and Abby. It says, Lower your voices. Everyone can hear you. Thomas has been having a years-long affair with Featherly, and Elita found the pillbox in Thomas's bedroom, in the trash. Well, Tag is the plotter, not Greer, but after 21 murder mysteries, she has learned a thing or two about motivation. Greer saw Abby last night when she went to the kitchen to pour herself the final glass of Veuve and left her pills on the counter. Abby had either snatched the pills up then or noted their existence.